Good morning.
Good morning.
I think we'll go ahead and get started. It's about a moment after nine, and I don't see any more people coming down the hill, so we'll get started. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, and this is the Bible study I explained yesterday to...
Talk louder, please.
Okay. I explained to the group yesterday that everybody at Holden has to have a title, what you serve the village as, and I went through the long history of how I switched roles between 2 weeks ago and now, and I'm serving the village as not Walt, because I am filling in for dear friend Walter Bowman, who is unable to be here due to illness. And I want to put a footnote to that today that I forgot to mention yesterday. I explained what I'm doing is basically the same with a few twists as a series I did 2 weeks ago, since the village changes population. And so these sessions are not being recorded. If you want to get a recording of this series of Bible studies, you look for the ones from 2 weeks ago, June 13 to 18, I guess it is. I, however, am recording them personally with my little digital recorder because I am on the clergy roster of the Missouri Synod, and I need to know everything I say. That were a joke. I also explained yesterday that I always start with alleged hilarity so as to sort of get it over with, as it were, and then be able to move on. And I chose something for today that needs a slight explanation. The truth is, a bit of full disclosure is warranted this morning. The title up on the kiosk and announced at breakfast is God Has No Name, But the Joke's on Me, which I may get to today. I am actually a bit behind. We're going to do some more sort of callings kinds of stories this morning of a different variety than the ones that we heard yesterday if you were here. The bit of alleged hilarity I brought this morning goes with that. It also goes with something that always happens at Holden Village. You find things out about people, even longtime friends. And you find things out about them at Holden that you never knew out there in the real world. And so for me, this piece connects not only with what I'm going to talk about this morning, but it connects with Vespers last night. What I brought along here is a letter to Ann Landers that I clipped out of the newspaper many years ago. And it is about a person with a quirk. And because we're at Holden, let me say that the people of other gender could have this same quirk. So I do not mean this to be sexist. In fact, it got proved last night that it can go both ways. Dear Ann Landers, I have been married to Dolores, not her real name, for 30 years. For the most part, we have had a good marriage, but Anne, there's something about Dolores that drives me crazy, and I don't know how much longer I can take it. On our wedding night, as we unpacked our things in the hotel honeymoon suite, Dolores pulled out of her luggage an accordion. I didn't even know that she played the accordion, but she played on and on that evening through several rounds of Lady of Spain and some drinking songs with surprisingly ribald lyrics. I was stunned. I could never have guessed how important her accordion is to Dolores. She takes it everywhere. To be frank, Anne, she doesn't play that well, and and only knows a few tunes. It's very difficult to listen to. But that's not the worst part. Dolores and I have never had much of a social life. In fact, our only real friends are Bernice and Murray. Whenever we get together, Dolores gets out her accordion, and Bernice and Murray join the act. Bernice clacks two spoons together to keep rhythm, and Murray makes hollow musical sounds by tapping on the top of his head while opening and closing his mouth to produce changes in tone. And I'm near the end of my rope. I love my wife, but I wish I never had to see Bernice and Murray again. And how can I tell Dolores that this racket is driving me crazy? Signed, Had It on Long Island. Well, you have to know. You have to know what Anne wrote back to it. Dear Had It, you've been truly wonderful. Please don't blow 30 years of sainthood by losing your temper or divorcing Dolores because of her accordion. Surprise her with a dozen accordion lessons and several pieces of sheet music. Sorry, I can't think of a thing you can do about Bernice and Murray. Perhaps just the kind of a story that, you know, helps you measure the precise severity of the quality of whatever crosses you bear. No, I'm not sure. I mean, how could you be sure about anything? Well, we looked yesterday at some call stories, and they have a pattern, and they communicate a number of things. They authorize or in retrospect. I mean, these stories are obviously collected and saved because they tell of the authenticity of someone who turns out to be a real prophet, and each of them in a way foreshadows what the life of a particular prophet will be like. Isaiah getting to prophesy only gloom and doom and driving his people into further and further darkness and despair until exile comes, and so forth. Today we're going to look at another series of stories that begins in the neighborhood of the burning bush and does something similar, but in a with a different kind of story and in a different way. So would you turn, please, if you have your Bible with you or one from the rack here, to Exodus chapter 2.
Fred, would you remind us of that call formula that you...
The pieces of the call narrative, every one of them has a summons from God, and the prophet then says, it's, you know, that in the literature it's usually called the objection or the demur. The prophet says, who me? I can't do this. Third part is God somehow answers the objection, and the last part, in one way or another, though they aren't always in the same order, the last part is the prophet accepts his or her role. I think we need a burning bush.
Is there a... And there was light. Is there also a part...
What you did, Antonio?
But I think you're full.
Okay. Fred, is there also part about the demise of the prophet or his end?
Well, some, you know, you could sense that that's foreshadowed in a couple of them, but that's not exactly a piece of it. Okay. I mean, the narrative itself has just those simple parts.
Okay.
that end with the prophet accepting and being then commissioned to do certain things. And in Isaiah's case, it's just destruction. In Jeremiah, it's partly destruction and a little bit of hope, and so forth. Okay, Exodus 2, take a running start at verse 11. We find that Moses has killed a civil servant of the Egyptian slave administration. And so now he is on the lam. And at verse 15, we read that Moses settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well, and the priest of Midian had seven daughters who came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock, but some shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and came to their defense and watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come back so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian helped us against the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he? Why did you leave him out there and invite him to come break bread?" So Moses agreed to stay with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah in marriage. She bore a son and named him Gershom, and so forth. So just a little story, kind of a little, almost in passing. Oh, by the way, while Moses was out there fleeing from the government, he ended up almost by accident getting betrothed and married to one of Reuel's daughters. Yesterday, recall, if you were here, that I said we got this father-in-law mystery. Sometimes he's Reuel and sometimes he's Jethro. Well, he's still the priest of Midian, but today he's Reuel. Yesterday he was Jethro. So yet another one of those little things about how this is strands of material from different sources having been drawn together. No big deal. I mean, it's just interesting to note how it is that Moses gets his bride. This story will have at least a little bit of a certain kind of significance later on. You don't hear a lot about Moses' wife in the history of the Exodus and the rest of the wilderness journey. She will, in a couple of chapters later, she will save his life in a bizarre story that I don't intend to spend much time on, though I suppose we could. Because it's one of the most mysterious stories in the Bible, and definitely in the wilderness wandering, when God comes and tries to kill Moses, and Zipporah quickly does a kind of quick emergency circumcision and saves the day. But but ultimately, Zipporah becomes an issue that brings about, or at least hastens, the demise of Miriam and Aaron, because much later in the story they are said to have complained that Moses had this non-Israelite wife, and they are struck with a disease for this, from which Aaron is said to have healed, but Miriam not completely. So this marriage does have some ripples, but generally speaking, it doesn't appear to have an enormous impact. But just to see how important it is, we need to go somewhat afield and see that this too is a kind of story that has a pattern and a long history to it. And I know some of you know this. This is old territory. Any of you who have ever, for example, been through a study by yourself or with others of Robert Alter's book on the art of biblical narrative will know about these stories. But they're also important for the Christian tradition. And so please go back, if you would, to Genesis. Genesis Genesis chapter 24. This is a 60-some verse story that we're not going to read in any detail. I will sort of paraphrase it. You can read it yourself while I'm talking, if you like. The human brain knows how to do that. Listen and read. This is Abraham getting a wife for his son Isaac. And the way he did it is to send a servant off to the homeland where he and Sarai had come from to find a wife from their own people for his son, because they don't want Isaac marrying just anybody. Such things were trouble even then in the perspective of this narrative. So the servant goes off back to the homeland, loaded up with wealth with which he's going to make the arrangement with whatever family he finds that'll enter into an agreement with him. He prays as he approaches a well that he will find just the right woman, and perhaps even at this well, and he asks God for a sign, or he proposes a sign to God about what this sign might be. And sure enough, just as he finishes his prayer, he looks up and here comes Rebecca. Daughter of one of his actually kinfolk, or his master's, Abraham's kinfolk's family. And he sees Rebecca, and she does the very things that were in his prayer as the sign that he wanted from God. And so he, in verses 22 and following, believes that this is the woman. And he converses with her briefly. And in verse 28, then, the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban, and he ran out to meet the man. And as soon as he saw the nose ring and the bracelets and all this stuff, he knew it was serious business. This is the story of Laban's life, you know, the eyes for gold. He invites the servant in, verses 31 and following, and they set food before him, verse 33 and so forth, and then they have long conversation about exactly how the servant came to this household and this place and what his proposal is, and they discuss the possibility that Rebecca might become Isaac's bride, and they finally decide, yes, this will all work, the finances seem to be in order. But they have to do one thing to make sure that this will work. And so in verse 57, they say, let's call the girl and ask her if she'll go along with this deal. And so Rebecca comes and they ask her, will you go with this man? And she says, I will. So they sent her away and her nurse along with her, with Abram's servant. And they blessed Rebecca. And they rise up on their camels and go all the way back to where Isaac is. And Isaac meets them when they get back with Rebecca and the entourage. And Isaac brings Rebecca into his mother Sarah's tent, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And so Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Okay? Long story of how Isaac got his wife. And without further ado, and even pausing to ponder this, we'll look at the next time a guy comes to a well when he's in a slightly odd place, and something similar happens in Genesis 29.
Unusual to ask the girl if she wants to go in a patriarchal society?
It is. It's very unusual. And we'll hang on to that because that's a detail we need to come back to. In Genesis 29, we have another guy who's fleeing. This time, he is Jacob, who has just cheated his brother out of the family blessing. Esau was the firstborn, and Jacob, who had tried to be the firstborn and failed, you know, Jacob was a womb wrestler, and he's always trying to get ahead of everybody, and it took him a while to get born first, but he's finally pulled it off by means of deceit, and now he is fleeing because of the anger of his brother. And Jacob went on his journey, and he came to the land of the people of the east. So now he's back where Abram's servant was, in the territory of his parents' homeland. He looked and he saw a well in the field and three flocks of sheep lying there beside it, for that was the well out of which flocks were watered, and there was a stone on the well's mouth, a large one. When all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place in the mouth of the well. In other words, it took a whole bunch of guys to move this stone. Jacob asked them where they come from. They said, from Haran. And do you know Laban? Sure. How's he doing? Fine. Here's his daughter Rachel coming with the sheep. Jacob said, look, it's still daylight, broad daylight. It's not time to water the animals. Water the sheep and go pasture them. But they said, we can't till all the flocks are gathered and the stones rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep. While he's still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his mother's brother Laban, and the sheep of his mother's brother Laban, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of his mother's brother Laban. So Jacob does what it usually takes several men together to do, a little moment of testosterone poisoning. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud, and Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman, that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. When Laban heard the news about his sister's son Jacob, he ran out to meet him, embraced him, kissed him, brought him home, and told Laban all these things. Laban said, surely you're bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, and he stayed with him a month. And then they make an arrangement that Rachel should be Jacob's wife, but you all know what happened. On the wedding night, Laban slips Leah into the tent, and for most of my life, I thought Jacob was some sort of fool who deserved whatever fate he got by not knowing what woman he was sleeping with. However, by the end of the week, you will find out the truth of this mystery. There's a perfectly a good and remarkable explanation for how Jacob didn't know, but that comes on Friday. This is the Holden version of Desperate Housewives. I know their tactics. All right, well, you know, there's three stories, and again, if you pay close attention to these three stories that we've looked at now together, there's a pattern to these stories. They're just like those call narratives of prophets. Every one of these stories has an Israelite man or representative or something, an Israelite traveling outside the home territory and comes to a well, somehow or another meets a woman at the well or a group of women. There's a conversation and there is watering that happens at the well, after which the woman or women run back to their homes and say, we met this guy. And they say, well, where is he? Bring him here. Let's have dinner. The man goes and has dinner with the family. They talk, negotiate, and end up with a marriage arrangement. Every one of those stories has that outline. The scholars of the Bible call this a type scene, named after what they find in the study of the Iliad and the Odyssey and other ancient literature, where you find a series of stories with a similar outline. And the stories have a particular function in a larger narrative. Now, to understand what the value of such stories might be, it's worth thinking about the modern equivalents of these things. We do exactly the same thing in our literature and especially in our popular culture. And we have to remember that this stuff we're reading was the pop culture of... I was only half joking about Desperate Housewives. This is also partly their entertainment back in an ancient civilization where the stories meant many things to them. But think about our own popular culture. My favorite example for how to get a feel for this is very dated, and you'll know how old I am approximately when I tell you that the best equivalent I know of to this are two things that happened in every one of those old black and white cowboy movies I used to watch on Saturday television when I was a kid and we first got our TV. Every one of those cowboy movies had two things you just knew would happen sooner or later. One of them was a chase scene in which one guy chases another guy, or sometimes it would be a woman, and they would go riding after each other on horseback, one of them trying to get away, and the one in front would be shooting back towards the one in the back. And finally, the one in the back would almost catch up, and then he would get out his lasso, and he would twirl his lasso, and he would get up, you know, whip it over the guy up in front, pull him off his horse, and beat the snot out of him, and then all would be well, or something like that. You know, and I began to notice after some years of this that they always rode past the same rocks. So there must have been a single set somewhere where all these things happened. And the other one, of course, that you always knew would happen is that at the near the end of the story, it just couldn't be finished, except you had two guys standing on either end of Main Street while everybody else scurried off and hid behind the doors of the saloon or up on the roof or under a wagon or behind a water barrel somewhere, and these two guys then, and the music would go and these two guys would stand there in silence, and one of them would pull and then the other one would pull, and they would shoot at each other, and one of them would die and the other one would be the winner. That's how every movie like that went. Except, we all knew the outline of this. We knew exactly how this was going to go. But we also knew, even as children, that there would always be some quirk to this story. It was always a good guy and a bad guy. And the way the story was supposed to work, of course, is that the good guy finally beats the bad guy and shoots him. But every once in a while, you knew very well the good guy was a chicken. Or he really couldn't do this. And you wondered, how is this going to work? And sure enough, somebody up on the roof would shoot at just exactly the right moment, and everyone would think the good guy did it, killed the bad guy, and even he might think so, and then suddenly he would have courage that he never had before. Or one of the two gunmen would have some quirk, like they'd be left-handed, and you're thinking the other gun is supposed to come, and so you get fooled, or the guy was... only had one arm or something. So So, you know, there was always some quirk that made the story slightly different, and it was the thing that made this particular one unique and fit this particular story. And we're still doing this. I mean, we don't have the quick draw on Main Street very often anymore, but we sure do have a chase scene. You can't have an action movie without a chase scene, you know, and if it's not two cowboys chasing each other with lassos, you know, it's the Star Wars version where you whip through God knows what kind of terrain. But anyway, that's how these scenes work. And so what's really important about them is that the audience, the reader, the viewer, knows the outline and watches for the quirks. What are the quirks of this particular story? So let's go back through these stories. Now we know the outline. Foreign territory, sit down at a well, meet a woman, talk, water, run home to tell the household, met this guy, well, where is he? Bring him here, come home, talk, betrothal. That's the outline. Now let's look at how each one is different. And we've already had the suggestion that certainly it's different that in Rebecca's story, they have to ask her, will you go along with this? That doesn't happen in any of the others. That one's really different. What else is...
That wouldn't even happen in culture, would it? To ask a woman permission.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it must, at least once. But it certainly isn't typical, of it, given the rest of the stories. It's not typical of what happens. So that they ask Rebecca, and she gets the last word, I will. What else is odd about... I mean, granted, it's only a sample of three so far. I'm going to show you some more in a moment. But what else is odd about the one with... in Genesis 24, with Isaac and Rebekah.
He's actively seeking a wife.
All right, in that story, there's the point is to go find a wife. In the other two, it sort of happens by accident.
Well, that story's not actually Isaac who's doing it. So.
All right. Isaac is not even in his own betrothal story. Somebody else goes and does this for him. And he just waits, you know, and on the horizon sees the consequence of the story of him getting a bride.
You really have to trust your servant.
Yeah, well, he got copious instructions at the beginning. There was basically a contract and with the servant. But this is typical, if you think about it. This is typical of Isaac's life, isn't it? Isaac, the story of Isaac is that he is Mr. Passive. I mean, all we really know about him is that he was born after this long, long ordeal of childlessness. And the next thing we know, God tells Abraham to go up, take Isaac up and kill him. And so they take Isaac up there, and Isaac says, gee, Dad, this is weird. as Abram prepares to kill him, he doesn't protest or anything. You know, this is strange. And the ancient legends in Midrash make much of the fact that, especially after this, you know, Isaac is really passive. Isaac doesn't really ever say much of anything. And the whole rest of his story, he's not the actor in his family. He is acted upon. He is passive. He is duped. He is blind. He is deceived by the ruse of Jacob putting hairy skins on him and so forth. This is the story of his life that he is done to and done for, acted out at his betrothal. And also, if you know this whole story, you know that Rebecca is the real actor in this family. Rebecca is Rebecca's the one who wants things to turn out a certain way, and they eventually will. Isaac loves Esau, but Rebecca loves Jacob, and Rebecca finds a way to make the one she loves get the blessing. What you should know, there's more to this than just storyline clues. Right in their names are the stories of their lives. Rebecca in Hebrew means noose. Rivka is a particular kind of noose, not the kind you hang people with, but the kind that you lay on the ground and then you wait for your prey to step in there, and then you go and you've got it. That's what a Rivka is. And of course you gave that as a name to someone because you did that in anticipation of the fact that they could snare a spouse, hopefully with their charm or their beauty or whatever. But in Rebecca's case, that's the story of her life. Everyone is in her noose. She is in charge. She lays traps for people, as she does for her husband, so that the world will turn out the way she wants. This is the story of their life, Isaac and Rebecca. The next one, Genesis 29, is Jacob and Rachel. I've already given you a clue as to one of the most odd features of this one. In Jacob's story, Jacob moves this enormous rock that normally it takes a bunch of shepherds to move. And he does it all by himself, and Robert Alter and others point out that this is the story of Jacob's life. Jacob has to do everything the hard way. His whole life is work to overcome the fact that he doesn't begin first. And so he spends his whole life struggling. His name, Yaakov, means he'll best you. Or even perhaps he'll cheat you. He'll find a way to supplant you and get ahead of you. That's what his name means. And of course, as we know, ultimately, he will get a different name, but only after a horrific fight. He will become Israel, the one who fights with God, because not till the end of his life does he learn who his real battle is with. It's not with everybody else, it's with God. But here his life is foreshadowed as the one who must always lift the rock himself. Moses. Moses' story is the brief one. It's just a few verses compared to this enormous thing in Genesis 24. But it's got all the parts. A man outside his home territory comes to a well, meets some women, watering happens, run home, bring the guy there, leaves with a wife. What are the quirks to that one?
It's his relative.
Pardon?
The woman isn't his relative.
All right, we finally have a story where we're going to actually marry outside the clan, which will become an issue. That does foreshadow something of Moses' life. This will eventually be a problem that he marries a foreigner. Although there will be great effort taken, I don't want to go into this, but later on there is great effort to try to show exactly who the Midianites were so that you can actually excuse Moses for this. Which would be necessary, of course, given case law that developed much, much later about marrying foreigners. You would have to be able to prove that this wasn't totally wrong for Moses to have done.
It's a question. his father-in-law is a priest of what?
Well,
different religion.
There's speculation that he's a priest of Yahweh, given certain clues, and the Bible, the larger narratives tries to show you that he is also connected to the true religion, so that Moses is not involved in something.
Well, there's the whole business about the shepherds having driven the women and their flocks away from the well.
Right.
And Moses rises to the defense.
Right.
The defense of the
enemy. Yeah. That's the major quirk in this one, is that Moses in this story has to play the role of rescuer. And the big clue is that when it says, I read from the NRSV, and it says he came to their defense, he defended them. The word that's used in the Hebrew at that point is the word for saving. In Hebrew, Yasha, the word from which we get the name Joshua and Jesus, Yeshua, that's the verb. He saved those women. And that is Moses' role in the larger story. Moses will become the savior of the people. So we get a little preview of Moses' life right here in his little betrothal story, just as we do with Jacob and just as we do with Isaac and Rebekah. So this is another kind of story that happens early on in someone's career that gives us a clue as to how their life will go. Now, it's not exactly a call narrative, and I'd like, if we end up with enough time later on, to think about the fact that some people get a call narrative and some people get one of these and some people get both. Just to give you a clue about how complicated these things ultimately get and how many of them there are once you begin looking, one of the stories where it's a little more difficult to see, but it's a perfect example of these ultimately, is the story of Ruth. Ruth is the story of a non-Israelite woman who comes from outside the territory into Israelite territory. And she doesn't come in and sit down by a well, but she comes upon the threshing crews at barley harvest time of Boaz's guys. And Boaz says to her, well, if you need any water, my guys will get some for you from the well. And meantime, why don't you come in and have dinner with the crew? And she goes in and sits with them, and they have food and they have wine, and then that night she ends up, and here's where the theme verse for the day comes in, take off your shoes. Ruth uncovers Boaz's feet, as it were. And a betrothal happens. She becomes Boaz's wife. And then at the end of the story, we read that she is among those who allows Naomi to be one who builds up Israel, like Leah and Rachel. So that's how this Moabite woman gets into the category of people who are known as those who built the people. It's one of those stories, except it's got all these huge quirks. Woman traveling. Now, many people, not everyone in the guild, but many people believe Ruth is at least in part a story that critiques the practice of forever banning foreign wives. You know, look, a Moabite. You know about the Moabites, don't you? You know, remember where the Moabites come from? Remember Genesis 19? The Moabites are the children of drunken incest up there on the mountain with Lot and his daughters. getting their father drunk and getting pregnant by him. Now that's considered heroic in some circles, but you know, you have to wonder if this is how the Moabites told their story of origin. This is what the Israelites love to tell about the Moabites, and this is a Moabite woman who's David's grandmother. So she gets one of these well stories, and she becomes a great ancestress of the people. One of the most interesting is the one that happens in the life of Saul. The story of Saul is so complex and undervalued. You know, in 1 Samuel, of course, they come to Saul, or the people have come to Samuel and asked for a king, and Samuel consults with God and is told this is the dumbest idea in the history of ideas. But go ahead and do it anyway because they won't listen to you. So Samuel goes out and he doesn't know how to pick a king. So he just goes out and finds the tallest, handsomest guy and says, well, I guess that's what a king looks like. So he goes, starts following Saul around until he can spring this on him in private, you know, in case it doesn't go well. So poor old Saul is out there looking for the family donkeys. His father has sent him out to look for lost donkeys. And Samuel follows him out there in the bushes and then springs this on him and then says, but don't tell anyone. So poor Saul has to go back to town and say, and they say, did you find the donkeys? And he didn't, you know, because he got all waylaid by Saul, you know. And so he can't even say, well, I didn't find the donkeys, but guess what? I'm the king, you know. He just kind of has to, like, well, no, I didn't find any donkeys. It was kind of a bad day. But while he's out there in the middle of all this, he comes almost to a well, and there are some women coming from the well. They have just been to the well, and he meets them. And instead of asking for water or joining them at the well, he says, where did that prophet go? Or actually calls him a seer, which is important, but not for this connection. And they say, he went that away. And so Saul diverts. And he goes, instead of to the well, he turns away and he goes off on this wild goose chase. And that's the story of his life. He became the king, but it didn't quite work. Halfway through what should have been a perfectly good story of being a king, it all went haywire. He loses God's favor, he goes crazy, and is destroyed. So his unfinished betrothal story is the story of his life. Okay, so by now some of you may be remembering that we Christians have one of these too. And the setup for it is in John chapter 3. While you're looking for this, or while you're turning to John 3, just ponder some of the people who don't get one of these stories. David doesn't get one of these stories. Doesn't get a call story. Doesn't get a well story. He gets a kind of trial story. He gets the test of a hero to see if there's the proper metal for becoming a leader or a hero or a king with the Goliath business. But he doesn't get one of these, either a call story or a story of one who will build up the people, kind of story and so forth. But John 3 closes with John the Baptist trying to say one more time that he is not the Messiah. Pardon me. And he says in verse 28 of John 3, you yourselves are my witnesses that I said I am not the Messiah. I have been sent ahead of him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him, that's the best man, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. For this reason, my joy has been fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease. So here we have best man announcing that the bridegroom is coming, and then in the very next piece of narrative, lo and behold, we have Jesus learning that he's got to be careful about Pharisees, starting back toward his home through an alternative territory. He comes to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon, and you should now hear music. If Jesus knows the Bible, he should be ready. If a Jewish guy outside the territory sits down by a well and read verse 7, a Samaritan woman came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, give me a drink. The disciples were out of the picture for the moment. The Samaritan woman said, you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a Samaritan woman? Jesus said, well, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that's saying to you, give me a drink, you'd have asked him and he would have given you living water. The woman said, you don't even have a bucket. What kind of water are you talking about? Jesus says, well, everybody who drinks this water gets thirsty again. But those who drink of the water that I give them will never be thirsty. And the woman says, well, I'll have some of that, so I never be thirsty or have to keep coming back here. Then Jesus says, go get your husband. And the woman says, well, that's not quite going to work. And they have the conversation about how often she's been married. Torah allows 3 marriages. She's been married 5 times and now has some sort of 6th relationship. They get into a very important, but not for our purposes, conversation about worship on this mountain and so forth. The disciples come back astonished that Jesus is talking to a woman. Meanwhile, the woman, verse 28, left her water jar, went back to the city, said to the people, come see somebody that told me everything I ever did. Could he be the Messiah? So they left the city and were on their way to see him. They eventually begin to believe in Jesus because of this woman's testimony. They invite him to come stay in verse 40. They asked him to stay with them, and Jesus stayed with them for 2 days. And more believed because of his words. They said to the woman, it's no longer because of what you said that we believe, but we've heard for ourselves, and we know that this is truly the Savior of the world. And when the 2 days were over, he left from there to go back to Galilee. And that's the end of the story. Same outline. Traveling outside the territory, stop at a well, meet a woman, converse, run back home and say, I met this guy. They say, well, where is he? They come get him, take him, have hospitality. What are the quirks here?
No marriage.
All right, Jesus doesn't end up, he doesn't leave with a wife.
Unless you're in the Da Vinci Code.
First Da Vinci Code or second Da Vinci Code? Yeah. Well, we've got all these problems solved now, but you know, Jesus was.
This woman would have known the stories of the Old Testament, wouldn't you? Because Samaritans would have. Didn't they follow the Pentateuch?
They had the so-called Samaritan Pentateuch, yes. And some of the case law is a bit different, but yeah, these are their traditions too.
I have an idea.
Okay.
If we look at this kind of metaphorically as the woman at the well representing maybe the church, and the church is the bride of Christ, and we are all fallen like she was, and with sort of the church universal because it's outside of Judaism, so maybe it ties together that way.
That's exactly what the ultimate message is, yes. That Jesus is ultimately the bridegroom, whose bride is, and we actually have the scene of the wedding in other Johannine literature, not the Da Vinci Code, but we still have 4 minutes. But in the Book of Revelation, where the bride adorned in all the proper attire comes to meet the bridegroom in Revelation 7. Well, how did Jesus get to be the bridegroom? How did he get his bride? Where exactly did that take place that he finally took his bride? He certainly didn't leave town with her that day back at Samaria. Where did he get her? Well, where he got her is the same place everything comes to fulfillment in John's gospel, and that is on the cross. There are several important quirks to this story in John 4. First of all, as we know, this woman is not eligible for marriage. Every other woman in these other stories is eligible, and it's pointed out. You know, Rebecca is a virgin fair to look upon whom no one had ever known. We're given Rachel's credentials. Reuel has these 7 daughters who are not married. This woman is not eligible. Secondly, Jesus asks for a drink and he doesn't get it. Watering does not happen. They talk about it, but nobody gets a drink in John 4. It's incomplete. One of the things we didn't point out is that every one of these stories talks about what time it is. In Moses' case, the question is, how'd you get back so early today? In Jacob's case, well, it's not time to water yet, but Jacob jumps the gun and does it anyway, etc. In John 4, it's noon. And people always play with that, and they say this is just another sign of this woman's being a loose character, because what you come to a well for at noon, you don't take home in a bucket. But I mean, that's in one of the commentaries. But that's got a different significance. That's got nothing to do with it. I mean, for all we know, this woman was widowed 5 times, and has now been befriended by someone because she couldn't marry again or whatever. We don't really know anything about this woman except she's a Samaritan who's had at least some heartache. But there will be another time in John's gospel when precisely at noon, Jesus will ask for a drink. And this time he will get it. Only in John's gospel does Jesus get a drink on the cross. By the way, he's crucified at 9 in the morning in the other gospels, so it's very important to John that it's at noon that he is crucified. And he asks for a drink. And you know what he gets in John's gospel for a drink? He gets a drink of achsus, which is not regular wine, but it's what we call wine vinegar. It's what people carried around when they were on duty in a foreign land, so you didn't have to drink the local water. But the way you say achsus in Hebrew is chometz, which is exactly the drink Ruth got at Boaz's dinner. So there is a linguistic connection between the drink that gets the wife in Jesus' story and the one from the foreign woman's story in the book of Ruth. So Jesus gets his drink. And so that drink that he gets in John's passion narrative is not only a Passover drink, it's not only drinking to the dregs the cup that the Father asked him to drink, it's his wedding drink. And he takes his bride there on the cross, And that's the bride then that we see. That bride is us. We are all the accordion players. So that's how we tie this all up. We can, it's exactly 10 o'clock. If somebody has a question or two, we could go over time for a moment, but we ought to honor the time. If people need to leave, please feel free. Thank you.